the new developments in the Karen Reed murder trial.
This has been a wild turn of events.
I've seen a lot of things. I've never seen anything like this. This case never ceases to amaze me.
It's a spectacle, that's for sure.
It was a hung jury, so no verdict, no real ending to this case.
Karen Reed was back in court where a date was set for her to be tried once again.
There are a lot of issues in this case.
Proctor was improperly searching Karen Reed's cell phone for nude photos.
Michael Proctor, the lead investigator,
relieved of his duties.
It's always the theories that each side will put forth for a jury to decide which one is more believable.
Karen Reed was drunk and angry and hit and killed John O'Keefe when she gunned it in the snowstorm.
Karen, did you ever say I hit him?
I did not.
There are more people here at the beginning of this than at the beginning of Johnny Depp's trial.
We're not concerned about any of the witnesses. None of the Commonwealth's witnesses are concerning us.
And once again, there was drama outside court.
There is a whole new set of legal troubles for Karen Reed. She is now facing a wrongful death lawsuit.
The lawsuit alleges that Karen Reed was drunk and reckless when she hit John O'Keefe.
It's not just Reed being sued here. The family also suing the two Canton bars from that night.
The two bars are liable for overserving her.
The FBI is investigating an investigation of a murder. That never, ever happens.
At this point, multiple jurors have been reaching out to both sides, saying that they are certain Karen Reed is not a killer.
I did not kill John O'Keefe. I've never harmed a hair on John O'Keefe's head.
We're looking at arm injuries with scratches. We're not looking at tire tracks.
There are 17 jurors, and they are coming and going with a police escort.
The investigation wasn't thorough.
This can't be good for the prosecution moving forward.
I just hope justice is served for either one, whatever it is, you know?
The fate of her life is not in her hands anymore. It's not in the hands of her attorneys. It's not in the hands of the prosecutor. It's in the hands of the jury now.
Week 3 started out with Hannah Knowles from Massachusetts State Police Lab. She's in forensic toxicology, and she was hired to do the math conversions on Karen Reed's blood sample from the hospital. Now, she actually started her testimony on Friday, and then it wrapped up on Monday. I explained this a little bit in episode 48 when Dr. Fowler testified about doing the serum test to determine Karen's blood alcohol level at the time that she was in the hospital. So the forensic labs use a whole blood test and hospitals use a serum test where they put the blood in tubes and then they put that in a machine that spins them until the parts of it separate, kind of like oil and vinegar dressing with the lighter part on top and the heavier part on the bottom. Now, in the serum test, the watery part is what's tested, but those results are always higher than the results from the whole blood test, usually about 13 to 19% higher, sometimes more. And the whole blood tests are known to be more accurate. So Knowles did some math, first making the serum results 13 to 19% higher to estimate what they would have been for the whole blood test. And for that, she got 0.078% to 0.092% for blood alcohol level. And remember, legal driving limit in Massachusetts is 0.08. Then she took those calculations and did a whole bunch more calculations, basically trying to count backwards to figure out what Karen's blood alcohol level would have been around 12:45. Now, the range that she gave of her calculations is 0.14 to 0.28% at 12:45 a.m. So this is retrograde extrapolation, and it's known to often be inaccurate because of so many varying factors. First of all, they don't know when Karen had her last drink. And on cross, Yannetti brought up Karen being angry at home, waiting on John to get there. So if she's sitting there drinking, waiting on him, then some of the alcohol in her system could have come from after 12:45. So in that case, Noel said the foundation of her calculations would be incorrect. So the results wouldn't be accurate. Other things can also impact it, like body weight, metabolism, medication, things like that. So basically, they can give this range, but they can't guarantee its accuracy in any individual. So the point here is that the prosecution wants the jury to hear a high blood alcohol concentration level, and the defense wants to make sure the jury knows you can't really rely on that. On day 9, we heard testimony from Ryan Nagel and his girlfriend, Heather Maxson. Ryan's sister, Julie Nagel, was at 34 Fairview celebrating Brian Albert Jr.'s birthday. She called her brother, wanting a ride home. So Ryan and Heather were out with their friend Ricky, and Ryan told his sister Julie, yeah, we'll swing by on the way home and get you. Now, as they were about to turn left onto Fairview Road, Karen and John were on the opposite side of the road, about to turn right onto Fairview.
I saw a vehicle coming at us, traveling on the other side of the road. They put their blinker on to take a right. I believe Ricky flashed his lights to let them go.
The car coming from the opposite direction was taking a right onto the same street, so we had somewhat yielded to the car coming from the opposite direction to have let them take a turn onto the street before us. I saw a male and a female inside the car. The female was driving and the male was in the passenger seat.
Ryan says they pulled up on the street in front of Fairview and Karen's SUV was still in front of them. Now, at one point he notices the brake lights turn off, the SUV moved forward about a car length and then stopped again. They waited about 2 minutes for his sister to come out of the house. And when she did, Ryan opened up the passenger door where he was sitting to talk to her. Now, Julie invited them to come in and have a drink, but they didn't want to. So Julie decided that she would just stay. So she went back inside. Once she was back inside, they started to leave. Ryan and Heather both described what they saw as they were leaving. Here's Ryan.
There was a woman in the driver's seat of the black SUV in front of me, sitting there with her hands on the steering wheel at 10 and 2. Their dome light was on.
So the argument for the prosecution here is that John O'Keefe was getting out of the car at the time that Ryan, Heather, and Danny were pulling away, and that's why the dome light was on, since John was exiting the car. Now, the defense's argument here is that John wasn't in the car when they were leaving, and they didn't see him outside of the car. It was dark. They weren't really paying attention. Heather said she may have checked her phone, so John could have walked up to one of the three doors up front in the house without them really noticing, but none of them saw anything. Now, there are two things to note about these testimonies. One, they both said they pulled up right where Jen McCabe said Brian Higgins' Jeep was parked, which means Higgins' Jeep could not have been parked there. And two, their estimates on the timeline could maybe be problematic for the Commonwealth's new theory. Brennan is suggesting that Karen hit John O'Keefe at 12:31 or 12:32. Ryan is estimating that they were there from 12:30 to 12:35. But when you have witnesses who've been drinking and they're giving time frames from years ago, who knows? He can't give an exact time. It's also worth noting that they both said that Karen was in the car by herself, just staring ahead. Not yelling, not fighting with anybody, nobody in the passenger seat. So each side is using this for their own theory. So Julie Nagel ended up staying for a little while longer and then got a ride home with the McCabes along with Sarah Levinson. Sarah Levinson also took the stand on day 9 and gave some information about who was at the house and what she saw. Now, when they got ready to leave, she said she was looking down at her feet where she was walking. So she said she didn't see anything in the yard. They got to the car. Matt forgot his jacket, so we went back in to get it, came back out, and then Sarah said they noticed a loaf of bread in the back seat. Now, Jen had said that she kept this in the car for her niece so that she didn't have to feed her McDonald's, but Sarah said Jen had just got the bread because of the storm coming, but either way, the bread and PB&J jokes are once again on the record. Sarah Levinson wasn't contacted to interview by Proctor or anyone else until October of 2022, 9 months after this happened. It's also worth noting that she's been good friends with Brian Albert and has known the family for a long time. She said she's been in the house like 20 times, but she's never met Chloe. Jackson asked, isn't that because Chloe isn't good with strangers? The objection was sustained, but the damage was done. This week, we also heard the testimony of Katie McLaughlin. Katie was working with Canton Fire Department and is one of the first responders who showed up at Fairview. She's also friends, or at least in the same friend groups, as Caitlin Albert, Brian and Nicole's daughter. Now, last year when Katie testified, nothing was really brought up about their friendship or their history. And then, on cross, Jackson asked her if she knows Caitlin Albert. Her response? I went to high school with a girl named Caitlin Albert. So, look, they did more than just go to high school together. Does that mean they're besties? No. Does that mean she's lying or hiding something to protect the Alberts? No. But what it does mean is that her credibility was shaky because it seems like a weird thing to try to hide or downplay. Now, after that, Jackson was able to show pictures of them together on vacations and group outings, and basically show the jury that whatever their relationship was, it was more than just, I went to high school with a girl named Caitlin Albert. But this time around, she did things how she should have done them the first time. Brennan asked her about it, and she explained their history. The pictures that were entered as evidence last time were not entered this time, and even though Brennan asked Katie all about her history with Caitlin, the defense had objection after objection when they tried to go through that line of questioning. Although Jackson did point out on cross that Katie's best friend is roommates with Caitlin. So here's where the important part comes in. Katie gives her story of what happened on scene, her version of the I hit him thing. And here's what she says.
Once we had come to a stop, I asked if there had been any significant trauma that happened that preceded this. And she answered with a series of statements that she repeated. I hit him. I hit him. There was a woman next to us who told her to calm down, stop talking, calm down, you're hysterical. So she repeated, I hit him. And a police officer asked her, said, you what? And she repeated it again, I hit him. And the officer then signaled for his sergeant to come down to the scene or down to where he was.
So aside from the I hit him being four times now instead of three or two, depending on who's telling the story, there's another issue with this. Katie says that it was Officer Seraf who heard Karen say this and then called for Sergeant Good to come over because of it. But Seraf said he never heard that. And his written statement says that Karen just kept repeating, is he dead? And his interview with Proctor was also just, Karen kept saying, is he dead? But last year, they specifically asked Seraf on the stand, and he said, no, he did not hear that. And Good didn't hear it. Not one officer on the scene heard her say that. And Jackson points this out during cross, and tensions rose.
Do you see him handcuff my client?
Oh, no.
You see him call anybody over to handcuff my client?
He turned to signal to get Goody down here is what...
So they handcuffed her?
No.
Right. They didn't handcuff her?
No.
Even though she just confessed in front of a police officer, according to you?
That's what she said.
I hit him. It's my fault. I did it. That's a confession, correct?
She said, I hit him.
And Officer Seraf just stands there and my client walks away, correct?
You'd have to talk to Officer Seraf about that.
Oh, we have.
You should.
Mr. McLaughlin,
objection.
Okay. So,
Jackson also takes the dash cam and slows everything down, pausing it and walking Katie through when she said that Karen said she hit him. And Seraf heard it and then called for Good. And Jackson points out that at the time that Katie said this happened, she said Jen McKay was telling Karen to calm down. She's hysterical. But in the dash cam, Karen looks calm at that point, at least for that moment. And he points out Seraf too, making a note that the video doesn't really show what she's explaining happened in that moment. Now, Katie also says that when Karen said this, Nuttall and Flamati were actually in the ambulance with John O'Keefe already, which means they couldn't have heard it. But Katie says she walks over and tells them about it. Now, remember, Nuttall said he heard it himself. The first time he mentioned hearing it, he said he overheard Karen say it to a female. And then later, he said he heard it himself while giving compressions. Jackson says, that means they heard it from you. So, false memory implanted? Maybe so. That was my theory in the last trial, and it still kind of stands. That's common in high-stress situations. But here's the thing. If Karen is screaming, I hit him, why would Katie not ask more questions about it? If you're there to save lives, wouldn't you want to know what you're dealing with and get details? Brennan does his best to explain this away with Katie McLaughlin and with Nuttall, but no amount of trying to minimize that or make it sound normal is ever going to make me think that that's normal. Katie says she didn't know what those comments meant, which is usually the exact reason why you ask follow-up questions. And she says she didn't want to ask Karen anything else because it was an emotional scene. The problem with this whole I hit him thing is that, look, if not one person on scene, no police officer and no first responder, took this as a confession, How can you expect a jury to? We'll be right back after this. This week, the jury was given their first look at what the investigation into John O'Keefe's death looked like. It started on Monday afternoon with retired Lieutenant Paul Gallagher from the Canton PD. I think Brennan wanted to really try to make this seem like it was a thorough investigation, and he was very specific with his questions. He also asked more leading questions than any prosecutor I have ever seen in my life, basically feeding the witnesses answers, but that's another story. So Gallagher walks through the investigation and his role in it, both before and after state police took over. Gallagher arrived as the last of the fire and EMT were pulling away. Gallagher kept referring to this as a medical episode and saying there was no need to investigate anything inside. When he was asked if he tried to get a search warrant or even asked to search the house, he said absolutely not. There was no probable cause. A dead officer in the yard of another officer is apparently not enough probable cause or even enough reason to just ask for consent to look around. But I really hung on the whole medical episode thing. It struck me because it isn't something that I remember Gallagher saying last year, and I didn't have it in my notes. I went back and looked and searched the transcripts, and sure enough, he never once used the word medical at all in any part of his testimony. Not once. But this year, he referred to it as medical 5 times. And it hit me. They want to trick the jury into thinking that there was no reason to do proper police work that you would expect at a crime scene. This is all an attempt to explain away how terrible everything was handled. And the direct testimony was a calculated line of questioning to mislead the jury into thinking that there was nothing done improperly, just a normal, everyday scene and cops doing the best they can in the snow. Gallagher mentioned seeing the blood and using the leaf blower, and this is how he explains it.
What was the benefit of a leaf blower over a shovel?
I wasn't going to miss anything with a leaf blower. Much better control.
And control, tell us what your intention, what was your hope with the leaf blower?
To clear the area, controlled, slowly, so any potential evidence of what happened to Mr. O'Keefe wouldn't be lost.
He also describes his use of solo cups.
Yes, they were red solo cups.
And what was the purpose of using the red solo cups?
They were plastic. They weren't going to leak. They weren't going to get soggy. They were large. I needed a small sample.
On cross-examination, Jackson asked about the solo cups, and Gallagher sounds so proud.
He had solo cups, and I utilized them.
The same kind of solo cups that we all see at backyard barbecues.
Yep, they hold liquid terrifically.
And Gallagher said the Stop and Shop bags are just like evidence bags, but cheaper.
In this particular case, we utilized the Stop and Shop bag. This made of the same paper, craft paper, the same size and dimension, other than Stop and Shop and evidence and probably price. They're basically the same bag.
Jackson points out on cross that the reason that there's a price difference is because they can guarantee where the evidence bags come from, but not the Stop and Shop grocery bags. So here are the big issues that Brennan and Gallagher wanted to kind of skate over. They didn't search the house or even ask to, and Gallagher says, no reason to. The witnesses who were in the house told us they weren't involved. The house had nothing to do with it, according to the people in the house, so we just kind of checked that off the list. They did the search with the leaf blower, and they were able to locate some broken cocktail glass that they collected, and of course the blood and solo cups. Now, Gallagher was the highest ranking there at the time, so he would normally be supervising everyone else, and then they would do reports, but he wouldn't do one. But this wasn't normal. Gallagher actually participated in the search. He was actually using the leaf blower. He even had Good record him on video using the leaf blower in case anyone had questions later. So since he took part in the search, that's something that you would do a report on. But Gallagher didn't. There is no report on anything he did that day, and he just kind of acted like it didn't matter. So What about video evidence? Jackson asked Gallagher if he asked Kelleher across the street for his video footage from his security camera on the porch.
I don't know if I did. I know it would not have.
How do you know it would not have?
Because I know what that camera captures.
How do you know what that camera captures?
Because I've picked up packages for Deputy Chief Kelleher in the past. I know it captures his doorstep and a portion of the front lawn.
So you've reviewed the Arlo footage from his iPhone?
No. He just sent me a picture. Can I pick up a, when he's been on vacation, can I pick up a package on the front step?
Okay. So,
yes, I've seen it.
So you've seen screenshots that
sure.
Deputy Chief Kelleher sent you, correct?
I believe so, yes.
He didn't bother doing that part of police work because he's picked up packages before from Kelleher's porch. Another waste of time. And here's another issue they tried to kind of skip over. Gallagher never saw where John O'Keefe's body was lying. By the time he got there at 7, John was gone. He says that Lank told him where John's body has been, although Lank didn't see it either. Good told him. But here's my question. If there was grass under John O'Keefe and 4 inches of snow had fallen, you should be able to see where he was, according to meteorologist Robert Gilman, who testified this week. In that 45 minutes, only an inch of snow is estimated to have fallen. So how would you not be able to see where he had been? This gave me more questions than answers. Those pictures of the whole leaf blower thing, there's no spot where it's like, oh yeah, that must be where he was. It's crazy to me. But also, this brings up another huge issue. Gallagher is the one who told the crash reconstructionist where the body was. So the crash reconstructionist, of course, didn't see, but he was told by someone who also didn't see, that was told by someone else who also didn't see, that was told by someone else who actually saw it. What could go wrong? Canton PD ended up being recused, of course, and the case was turned over to state police. In a really weird moment on the stand, Gallagher seemed like he was trying to pretend like he didn't know Proctor was the lead investigator. I think now that Proctor has been fired, everyone wants to either blame him for everything, distance themselves from him, or just pretend like he didn't have anything to do with the investigation, as if he wasn't part of the entire thing. After the case was turned over to state police, Gallagher didn't have much else to do with it other than showing the crash reconstructionist. But here's the wildest part. Nobody at the DA's office even talked to Gallagher or interviewed him about this case in any way until April of last year, right as the first trial was starting, 2.5 years after John's death. How is that possible? We know he didn't write a report, so they weren't just relying on that. So how did it take them so long to talk to the lead person in the Canton investigation and crime scene search? That is wild to me. But I guess I shouldn't be surprised. After Gallagher's testimony, Brennan played 2 more clips from Karen Reed's interviews for the jury. One is her telling the reporter that John grabbed her vodka drink when he got out of the car. The jury just heard about pieces of the cocktail glass that were found. And the second clip is Karen telling a reporter why she thought she could have hit John when she was first trying to figure things out in the chaos.
He asked, why was I saying, could I hit him, did I hit him? And I said, yeah, my first thought was, I'd been out late, I'd been drinking, and he's in the general vicinity of where I last saw him. I mean, they talk about the left side of the property and the right as if it's, you know, Hammersmith Farms. It's a postage stamp. It's 50 feet. So he's in the front yard to the left of the front door, and no one's coming out of the house. Jen's telling me nobody's seen him. So I'm thinking, Jesus, was I starting to pull away and I ran over his foot? Like, he's roughly where I left him. So yeah, when I found him, I was thinking, did I like clip him somehow?
This clip is somewhat ironic since we heard in the juror interview that some of the jurors were thinking the same thing that Karen was. She was drinking. He was in the yard. Could she have hit him? Another clip is played where Karen is saying the same thing to Dateline.
I mean, I didn't think I hit him, but could I have clipped him? Could I have tapped him in the knee? And he decapitated him. He didn't looked mortally wounded as far as I could see. Well, could I have done something that knocked him out and in his in drunkenness and in the cold didn't come to again?
In this particular moment, you would run him off at the party.
Would have had to.
So Brennan uses some of his other witnesses this week to try to support that theory. The meteorologist gave a lot of information about how little snow had actually fallen that night and into the morning, with the majority of it falling after 6 a.m. Now, this part actually supports more of the defense's arguments, especially with the officers not being able to see grass where John had been, and nobody leaving from the party being able to see John in the yard when they left. And the visibility was actually pretty high as opposed to the whiteout conditions that had been explained before. But they did get the meteorologist to say that the ground was frozen. Now, when ARCA brought this up, Dr. Rentschler said that you would have to do freeze and thaw cycles for weeks leading up to that day to be able to know. But the meteorologist said he checked for the 3 days leading up to it, and he says it was frozen. And they played angry voicemails that Karen left when she dropped John off and went to the house. She's yelling at him, telling her that she hates him, accusing him of using her and cheating, and telling him nobody knows where he is. She called him 52 times and left 8 voicemails between the time she dropped him off and 6:03 that next morning. Now, to me, these clearly show that she didn't know where he was. Nobody leaves angry voicemails as an alibi like that, and then wakes up calling people and asks everyone at the scene if she could have hit him. But it's part of Brennan's theory. Angry Karen hit John and then went home. The dash cam is shown from Karen's car around 8:23 a.m. Snow is caked on it at that point, so it's hard to see it very clearly, but we can see part of the taillight is cracked and a piece is missing. This is the piece the defense says she cracked when she hit John's car, but the prosecution argues it was from hitting John O'Keefe. We'll be right back after this. Now, one of the biggest disputes in this case is why there was a search done in the daylight with a leaf blower at 7 a.m. and no taillight was found, and then another search was done in the dark around 6 p.m. after 9 inches or more had fallen, and then they were able to find taillight. So the jury heard from Gallagher about the first search, and they also heard this week from Lieutenant Kevin O'Hara with CERT, Special Response Emergency Team, and Trooper Connor Keefe from Massachusetts State Police. Now, O'Hara and the CERT team members arrived at Fairview at different times, the first just before 5 p.m., and the last at 5:41 p.m. O'Hara says they lined up, focusing mostly on the road because the yard was hard to clear, and they worried about the road evidence because they didn't want it to get destroyed. So Lieutenant Tully showed up with some people that O'Hara said he didn't know and didn't recognize, and Tully took over as lead. One of the troopers to show up with Tully was Trooper Keefe. The first piece of taillight was found at 5:45, and O'Hara says when they found taillight, they placed it on the snow pile to document where it was found. They also found John's shoe. Now, as they found things, Tully would take the pictures, and then Keefe would put it in a bag. Interestingly, O'Hara said all 6 or 7 pieces that they found were all in one concentrated area, each within inches to a foot or so. But over the next days and weeks, 40 more pieces would be turned in as evidence, some gathered from undocumented searches, some as officers are just randomly driving by on their way to work. O'Hara and his team were there to do their job, and he asked Tully for a picture of the broken taillight that they were looking for so they would know. Tully told him he can't get a picture. He said the car is on a tow truck being taken in right now. However, that wasn't true. The car had already been at the Canton Sallyport before the CERT team even got clearance to begin. Yet another excuse of why we don't have a clear picture or video of when that SUV came in. Trooper Keefe brought in evidence to show what was collected from that CERT search, and there was an interesting moment. As Keefe is pulling out 2 pieces of red taillight, Brennan asks him if he only put 2 pieces in there, and he confirms that. But there's a 3rd piece in the bag. Brennan asked Trooper Keefe if that piece broke off of the others, or if he knows about it. Keefe said he doesn't know. Brennan tells him to just put it back in the bag, but the defense asked to be heard. Now, when they come back from sidebar, the third piece is taken out and marked independently as its own exhibit. Not really a good look for the Commonwealth that their evidence is breaking. There's another issue with evidence that arises later, too, so stay tuned for that. Keefe was on the stand for a relatively short time, but during cross, there was one thing that was made very clear. He didn't want any part of whatever Proctor's role is in all of this.
He was the lead investigator writing the report, correct?
Yes, he wrote this report.
He chose the language to use in that report, correct?
I did not have any input on how he wrote this report.
Right.
Yes, again, I only got a copy of the surveillance video.
Sure.
I did not do any analysis.
It seems like everyone is trying to distance themselves from Proctor, and also trying to dance around answering whether or not Proctor is the lead investigator. Which, by the way, we all already know. Trying to pretend like it's all a team effort now is kind of pointless. But there was one other thing that Keefe said that stood out. He said he attended the autopsy of John O'Keefe, but apparently Trooper Proctor didn't. That's kind of wild for a lead investigator to not show up for the autopsy, especially since it's the death of a cop, and there's still an investigation going on. They don't know what happened yet. That's part of what the autopsy is all about. This was done on January 31st, before Karen Reed was charged with anything. But even if she had already been charged and they believed the case was solved, it's crazy that Proctor didn't go. And to make it even worse, neither did Buchanick. There's one other witness that was brought in after Trooper Keefe on Wednesday, and I'm not going to spend a ton of time on her testimony, but I do want to point out a few things. Digital forensics expert Jessica Hyde was back on the stand to give her thoughts on the Google search and deleted data from Jen McCabe's phone. Before she even took the stand, the defense had some issues about it that they wanted to take up with the judge. There was apparently another trial that Hyde was hired to testify in. She was giving an opinion on digital data. In this case, it was location data, and the judge ruled her unreliable for this. Since there is no Apple source code, there are a lot of things that have to be assumed in order to accept her opinion here. And for various reasons, the judge said that's not reliable enough to allow it to come into trial. So Alessi made the argument that this is pretty much the same situation, explaining that Hyde isn't using Apple source code to find out where the data is located and what it means. She's using a surrogate to do that, exactly like in the other case. He wanted to bring in a copy of that judge's ruling and cross-examine her on it, since it calls into question how reliable her methods are. Now, Brennan accuses Alessi of trying to malign Hyde with something unrelated. Then, in true Brennan fashion, he musters up all of his theatrics and drama and all of his hypocrisy and accuses the defense of trying to dehumanize Hyde. Reminder, this is coming from the man who literally yelled at an expert witness and accused him of hiding information and lying on the stand and basically of being unethical. Yeah, that guy is saying that Alessi is trying to dehumanize his expert by wanting this included. Hypocrisy isn't a good look, especially for an attorney. The judge ruled that Alessi can cross Hyde on this, but she's excluding the court decision, and the testimony is allowed. Now, I'm not going to go into detail about the technical stuff here. If you want to hear Hyde's technical arguments, there are more of those broken down in episode 20. But her conclusions are still the same.
What I can state to a scientific degree of certainty is that that search occurred at 6:24 a.m. and was the last search in the tab that had been opened at 227.
Do you have an opinion to a degree of scientific certainty whether there was any other searches similar to How's Long to Die in the Cold that evening on that tab?
Just ensuring that I have the question correct.
Please.
You're asking if what else occurred in that tab prior?
Yes.
That I cannot say with a clear degree of certainty.
Okay. So, she says she can guarantee that the search happened at 6:24, which nobody is denying, but can't guarantee what happened in that same tab earlier in the night or morning. She also doesn't think that Jen McCabe self-deleted items from her phone. She thinks it was the system. But more interestingly, when she was explaining this, we heard that Jen McCabe made more than 200 calls in the time frame of 8:29 a.m. on January 29th until her phone was turned over on February 1st at 12:08, according to Trooper Keefe. Now, that's a lot. Let's just assume Jen is sleeping 8 hours a night. That means that she was making a call every 15 minutes for the rest of those 16 hours each day. That's crazy to me. I've made 3 phone calls last week. Now, during cross, Alessi points out some other issues with her report. And although they are being pleasant toward each other, it seems like there was definitely some tension. Hyde actually kept correcting Alessi and Brennan on different things. And she interrupted Alessi a lot. But here are the main points I saw during cross. 1, Hyde confirmed that John O'Keefe's phone was not put in a Faraday bag or secured in any way since it was still recording and receiving data up till noon. Now, I have more on that to come. I had a huge moment with all of that information that I'll be going over. And the other big point I saw on cross is that there was still movement and user interaction on John O'Keefe's phone after 12:30, and Hyde's report had none after 12:24. Now, the technical testimony can be tedious, especially when the attorneys are making objections. It wouldn't be so bad if the judge allowed the attorneys to state the reason for their objection like every other normal court in the world, but yet here we are. Judge Cannone would rather prevent them from doing that and then complain because they want to go to sidebar. Now, this happened, and the judge made a comment in front of the jury when Alessi objected.
Diane Cole.
That is correct.
Now, I want to ask you, to a reasonable degree of forensic data, scientific certainty, what is your opinion about whether the phrase "how's long to die in cold" was made at the time of the timestamp 2:27:40?
Judge, Your Honor, may we approach?
It's the last time, Mr. Hassan, on this issue, okay?
It was out of line, and after lunch, the defense must have said something about it because the judge addressed it to the jury.
As you know, I think I told you in the beginning, one of my functions is to make sure that a case is tried fairly and efficiently, and not to waste anybody's time. So if I get frustrated at lawyers about something, I try not to, and I don't think I can, but if I seem to cut somebody short, the lawyers are just doing their job. When they request sidebar conferences, they're just doing their job. I am going to try and keep all sidebar conferences to a minimum, but the lawyers are just doing their job. Okay.
So I think it was great that she let the jury know this, but the way she said it, if she gets frustrated, but she doesn't think she does, but if she does, it's just because she doesn't want to waste time hearing what the defense attorneys have to say. Look, I don't know if this made it any better, but at least maybe it will make her more aware of her comments. So we're now at the end of week 3, and the order of witnesses has been very different than the first trial. At first, it seemed really all over the place. I even made a joke about how Brennan just sent out a sign-up sheet and had people come in when they can. But I know Brennan's style at this point well enough to know he's very calculated, and he does everything for a reason. I tried to think like a prosecutor, the kind who just wants to win, not the kind who wants justice or truth. And not even halfway through this week, I realized exactly what he's doing. What are Brennan's biggest problems? 1, there's not enough evidence that supports their theory. I mean, they've even had to change their theory a few times to make it work. And 2, witnesses who aren't credible and get destroyed on cross-examination. And 3, terrible investigation right from the start. And 4, Proctor. So how does Brennan try to overcome that? He presents what will appeal to emotions and hides everything that will expose the truth. He wants the jury to dislike Karen, and he wants to keep everything else that points to everyone else as far away from the jury as possible. Think about his openings. Brennan started with talking about Nuttall, the hero who came out of the ambulance with the cold wind on his face, trying to save the life of Officer O'Keefe. And when Karen looked at him and said, "I hit him, I hit him, I hit him," it was this dramatic moment. He lays it all out. She was drunk, angry, jealous, and backed into him, leaving him to die in the cold. He needs the jury to dislike her and believe that, and believe that nothing else could have happened reasonably. So he presents everything he can to accomplish that while hiding everything that goes directly against it. He starts out with Nuttall, the hero, in his openings. Hero goes to save a life and Karen says, "I hit him." And then he plays the clip of Karen talking about it afterwards. He moves on to the cracked taillight. He brings in Carrie Roberts. And last year it had a little black hole in it. But this year, Hank knew that wouldn't work. He showed a picture of the taillight from February 1st. It's completely smashed, definitely not a little black hole. And Brennan asked Carrie if this was accurate, and she says yes, despite her previous description. Then a video clip about the broken taillight is played. Now he needs the jury to dislike her, makes it easier to believe she's guilty. So he brings in John's mom, who every juror will obviously sympathize with. Mrs. O'Keefe makes it clear that she didn't like Karen, and then Brennan follows up with a clip of Karen imitating the accusatory tone that she said Mrs. O'Keefe had. Then bring in Whitley, who said that Karen's behavior was bizarre, and she was giving the nurses a difficult time, and she couldn't raise the kids on her own. He said that she said, "Not my kids." Now the alcohol. The texts are entered. Clips are played of Karen saying she was buzzed. The blood alcohol and extrapolation are given. Whiffen comes in to say, ignore the Apple health data. John never went in the house. And Jen's Google search isn't until the morning, not 2:27. Trying to set up credibility for Jen, who's next. She plays up the normal small-town mom thing to the jurors who didn't see her testimony last time, so they have nothing to compare it to. Trust me, I'm just a normal mom. And Jen brings up Bella's mom. Because now he needs motive. And it's a stretch, and he knows it, so Brennan plays clips of Karen saying that she thought John was cheating, and a clip of her saying Jen McCabe used Bella's mom's house to give directions. And now he needs them to think this is the only option. Ryan and Heather are brought in to say they didn't see John in the car and the dome light was on. Brennan says that must mean that he was getting out of the car as they were driving off and they just didn't see him. He has to be careful who he brings in to say that they never saw John come inside because cross on most of the witnesses would be damaging to his case. So he brings in Sarah Levinson for that. Now he needs to explain away the bad investigation. Make them think it doesn't matter. Gallagher never once mentioned the word medical in his testimony last year. But this time, he calls it medical 5 times. No reason to search the house if it's a medical situation, right? They found the cocktail glass. Then a clip is played of Karen saying that John took hers when he got out. He also has to explain the injury since the medical examiner doesn't really corroborate his theory. So he plays the clip of Karen saying she thought she could have clipped him, and he was roughly where she left him. Then the meteorologist tells us that the ground was frozen to explain the head injury. The angry voicemails are played. He wants them to see that she's angry and says he's cheating and is calling him over and over. And dash cam video from the wellness check is brought in to show her cracked taillight. O'Hara and Keefe talk about the search. He's now trying to narrow the timeline so that the jurors don't think there's time to plant evidence. Brennan has laid out an entire case based on making the jury dislike Karen while hiding everything else from them. And of course, one of the things that they want to hide, apparently, is Proctor. The news came out this week that the Commonwealth will not be calling Michael Proctor to the stand. They probably aren't going to call Brian Albert or Brian Higgins or anyone else that we heard from last time where the defense was able to really go hard on them during cross. Brennan has intentionally left out everyone who makes his case look bad, and that puts the defense in a position to have to make the decision to call them or not. It's definitely interesting, but while they may want to avoid Proctor, they can't avoid Buchanek. He took the stand on Thursday and testified on into Friday, and I have a lot to say about him. That'll be in the next episode. My name is Brandy Churchwell, creator of 13th Juror Podcast. If you're enjoying it, please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts and Spotify, and share this episode with your friends. For more information, photos, and episode guides, visit our website at 13thjurorpodcast.com.